Morning, everyone. We welcome you to our Sunday morning roundtable discussion with our topic of truth today. We're so glad you all could join us. We are recording this morning from the Plainfield Christian Science Church Independent in Plainfield, New Jersey, the United States of America. And again, we welcome you all. And we'll start with our morning prayer.
I'm reading from page 20 of the Collectanea Addenda. To know there is but one God, one cause, one effect, one mind heals instantly. Have but one God, and your reflection of Him does the healing. When truth first comes to the consciousness of a mortal, it usually heals him physically. Then comes the demand to commence giving up material idols and to digest, assimilate, and demonstrate truth for himself. At this period, the conscious and unconscious efforts of evil strive to obstruct, to continue the bondage, and to cause the individual to simply handle his newfound treasure, talk about it, perhaps with fervor or emotion, but to go no further. I advise you to do what you think is right and never lose an opportunity of doing good. Ask wisdom of God and He will guide you. Mary Baker Eddy.
Thank you very much. Okay, Karen.
Watch number 43. Watch, lest you believe that it is the denial of error that destroys it. To be sure, Missivity tells us on page 339 of Science and Health that we conquer error by denying its verity. But to conquer it does not destroy it, any more than to conquer a burglar puts him in jail. But it does stop his further depredations and restrains him until the police come and take him away. Our denials of the verity of error conquer it, but only our affirmations that let in the power of the truth destroy it. It is necessary to repeat that our denials do not heal or destroy error, but they put it underfoot and make way for the healing efficacy of truth. Denying darkness does not let in the light, but it takes away one's fear of it and bondage to it, thus opening the way for the light to come in.
Thank you very much. Good one. Any comments on that?
Well, I've been doing better at quickly knowing what the nature of the problem is, whatever it is, whatever the condition, understanding its nature, which is illusion, and knowing it has absolutely no power. And then quickly getting to the fact that God is the only power. And that quickly gets me off of the situation much, much quicker when I just know what it is, what the nature of it is. It has no power, and then just consecrate my understanding of the truth, that it has all the power.
Thank you. Anybody else?
It's too easy to flippantly deny the error, say, oh, that's not true, and then continue about your day. So it's very important to get back to the truth always.
Thank you. Go ahead, Florence.
Well, to me, what has really helped me is to know that this has no power. God would never send anything inharmonious to his children. So right here, I know that there's no power. But the affirmations and all the truth I know, or what I've read in the books, by themselves do not do the healing. It's the presence of God. So I like what Mrs. Eddy said to have that constant relation with the divine, so that you are always awake to the fact that you are in the presence of God. And that, to me, has done a lot for me. That presence, knowing that God is here. If God is here, then error has no chance. He fills all space. So that has been really very helpful for me. Because just the words, you know, it becomes a little bit sometimes, it's even kind of arduous, you know, you say it and you say it and they say, oh, well, I've been saying the truth, I've been knowing the truth. But what to what effect? For God's presence or not? So it has helped me.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yeah, this reminded me too of what Jesus says in the Bible about the person that swept their house of the devils. But if you leave a vacuum and don't replace it with something, it just gets replaced with, you know, more error, more devils. And so this watch was really helpful to me because you can deny the truth all day long, but if you're not also, you know, embracing the allness of God and feeling it, then you've kind of left this vacuum in your thought.
Thank you. Yeah, Era wants you to just get on one point or get on even the negative side of it rather than bringing in the truth that heals. And so this is a very important watching point. All of them are, but we certainly have to open up the way for the light to come in. It does that, but then that light must come in and shine on us. So thank you. Anybody else with that? All righty.
Well, and Nassetti instructs us that, you know, if we seem to be exposed to error or subject to it, reverse it. It's the reverse of error that is true, and dwell on the truth. And it's the truth that destroys the error. Not denying the error does not destroy it.
Thank you. All right, Jeremy, would you do the golden text?
Hebrews, let us hold fast to the profession of our faith without wavering, for he is faithful, that promise.
Thank you. Yes, here again, the importance of faith, that we have faith, knowing that God will hear us and help us, and we are one with him. So, Nancy, would you read what you found, please?
Yes, sure. I looked up the word faithful in the 1828 dictionary, firm in adherence to the truth and to the duties of religion, firmly adhering to duty, of true fidelity, loyalty, constance. In prose works, Mrs. Eddy writes the following. Obeying the divine principle which you profess to understand and love demonstrates truth. Never absent from your post, never off guard, never ill-humored, never unready to work for God, is obedience, being faithful over a few things. If in one instance obedience be lacking, you lose the scientific rule and its reward, namely, to be made ruler over many things. And that's on page 116 in Miscellaneous Writings. And then I also found the following. The spiritual elevator to the human race, physically, morally, and Christianly, is the truism that truth demonstrates good and is natural, while error or evil is really non-existent and must have produced its own illusion, for it belongs not to nature nor to God. Truth is the power of God which heals the sick and the sinner, and is applicable to all needs of man. Truth is supreme and omnipotent. Then whatever else seemeth to be intelligence or power is false, deluding reason and denying revelation, seeking to dethrone deity. The truth of mind healing uplifts mankind, by acknowledging pure mind as absolute and entire, and that evil is not, although it seems to be. Pure mind gives out an atmosphere that heals and saves. Words are not always the auxiliaries of truth. The spirit, and not the letter, performs the vital functions of truth and love. And that's also in miscellaneous writings.
Thank you. It was just what we were talking about, what Lawrence was bringing out too. It's the spirit, not the letter. It's the feeling of the Christ presence yes. with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now I have, this was a beautiful article that Carrie sent on faith that I'd like to share. It's by a Reverend Orchard. It says, faith is a widely influential process. It takes us down to the very center of ourselves. Faith is never difficult, but infinitely simple, because faith is what we all believe deep down. It is covered up in most of us by false creeds, fear, and stale custom. But we can always break through these things if we will. You say that you believe that nothing but force is now of any avail. You do not really believe it. That is simply the self-hypnotism of people obsessed by fear. Faith is thinking through your delusions until you come to the core of truth. It's thinking through your delusions until you come to the core of truth. Deal with yourself on your knees before God. Find out what you really believe. For since man is one, we must all believe alike when we get down to the foundations, down to the foundations. Fight the good fight of faith, first of all in your own heart. Never mind what you think is practical or what you feel you can keep faithful to. Get to the truth of your deepest trust. Accept the truth and leave it to work with its own power. It is the fear and self-delusion in the hearts of those who profess the Christian faith which is keeping the world chained to this fatalistic damnation. The gaining of faith for yourself will liberate faith in others. That definition of delusion is a fixed or persistent false mental conception, resistant to reason with regard to actual things or matters of fact. So, you see, in order to get to the faith, you have to dig past all these delusions that we've been raised with, to think that error is real, all kinds of false theology. And as you do that, you will come to this truth, and you will have that faith. In miscellaneous writings, Mrs. Eddy, it speaks about Mrs. Eddy, where it says, within, on page 169, within Bible pages, Mrs. Eddy had found all the divine science she preaches, noticing all along the way of her researches therein, that whenever her thoughts had wandered into the bypaths of ancient philosophies or pagan literatures, her spiritual insight had been darkened thereby, till she was God-driven back to the inspired pages. Early training through the misinterpretations of the word had been the underlying cause of the long years of invalidism she endured before truth dawned upon her understanding through right interpretation. With the understanding of scripture meaning had come physical rejuvenation. The uplifting of spirit was the upbuilding of the body. She affirmed that the scriptures cannot properly be interpreted in a literal way. The truths they teach must be spiritually discerned before their messages can be borne fully to our minds and hearts. So, sorry, just a minute. Just make sure you are digging deep now to get this truth, because it's available to all of us. But you see, we can be blinded by the old theology and other things that try to keep it from us. So the truth is ever available. We just must feel it and look for it.
And fortunately, Christian Science explains to us how we can do that. Because, I mean, how does truth come to us? Through inspiration, right? Is there any other way than through inspiration that the truth comes to us? We can read about it, but unless we feel it inspired, we're not going to really get it. But if we get it, we get it through inspiration. Any other source, whether it's our material senses or whether it's, you know, literature that is not inspired, is going to get us off track. And that's why we have to trust our spiritual sense, because that is the inspiration that comes from God. And it's a challenge at times.
In the Herbert Rieke, which we talked about last week, his depths of being. Last week we talked about the depths of life. This week he speaks, or I'm sharing with you, the depths of truth. He says, may we talk now about the depths of truth. Our leader says we must look deep into the realism instead of accepting only the outward sense of things. And then he says, some years ago, I was confronted with a rather serious problem. I declared over and over again that God good was all powerful and ever present, and that evil, therefore, was powerless and nowhere. But harmony did not seem to be manifested. I stopped my repetition of words and asked myself, do you really believe that God is all powerful and ever present, that evil has no power anywhere at any time? After making an honest examination of my thinking, I found that I was far from realizing the great truth. Instead of becoming discouraged, however, I acknowledged that a thorough house cleaning was needed. I asked over and over again, do you believe God is so everywhere present that sickness, sin, and lack are nowhere with anyone at any time? I looked out of my office window over a troubled world and sighed. It's difficult. The material senses argue that evil was present and powerful. It was easy enough to say just words, but to realize the truth with all one's heart and soul and mind was quite different. I discovered that it took radical reliance on truth to be a real Christian Scientist. Material sense did not give me the correct answer, and so I turned wholeheartedly through spiritual sense to God. I asked the above questions many times without answering outright. Each time I turned from the material mirage to spiritual reality, it became easier and easier. Finally, the testimony of spiritual sense was so overwhelming and predominant in my thinking that I could answer with a feeling of positiveness. Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief. To my great joy, I found a wonderful sense of harmony reigning where discord had seemed to be. You see, I was probing deep into the eternal truth instead of being satisfied with just the outward appearance of things. At another time early in my experience, I found my thought becoming somewhat clouded. I prayed, but my prayer seemed empty to me. While reading in the book of Hebrews, I came upon the passage, he that cometh to God must believe that he is. I closed the book and asked myself, do you really believe that God is? You talk about God, you read about him. But how real is he to you? Is he as real as this chair or the table or the electric light? Is he as real as your mother? I began to ponder carefully this last question. I was very certain of the existence of my mother. I talked to her and she listened to me. I knew I could call upon her on the phone and ask her to do anything for my welfare, and she would be very happy to do it. No one could bring any doubt into my thinking as to the nature and existence of my mother. I ask myself, am I just as certain of the existence and love of God? I was surprised to find that my sense of God's existence was rather nebulous. I could see that I was going to be a Christian. If I was going to be a Christian Scientist, I must deal with God as a great reality in my life and not just a vague theory or ideal abstraction. I proceeded to talk to God as my nearest and dearest friend. I unburdened myself and asked for help and inspiration. In a few minutes, I found myself realizing that I must be more unselfish about a certain matter, and I should be more conscientious in my study and work, that I must be more patient and kind. Suddenly, I realized that thereby God was talking to me in terms that I could not be mistaken. I heeded this divine advice and soon found myself entertaining an entirely new, alert, and happy sense of things. What is real to you? Platitudinous words about the omnipresence and the omnipotence of God is not enough. There must be deep convictions. This is Eddie said of Jesus' prayers, that they were deep and conscientious protests of truth, of man's likeness to God and man's unity with truth and love. She also tells us that we should plead with honest conviction of truth and a clear perception of the unchanging, unerring, and certain effect of this divine science. Then, if your fidelity is half equal to the truth of your plea, you will heal the sick. It goes on, but I think he makes such a good point. And this idea of finding out more about the depths of our being, the real truth, not to settle for anything superficial, but keep digging and feeling his presence and power.
Some wonderful honesty, too.
It is honest, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Especially since this was from the 1964 address, so he'd been doing it a few years.
He had, yes. And it's so important that we, get on our knees to God and truly ask how we can do better. And when we have that deep desire, and to know the truth and the truth to make us free, these things will happen, won't they?
Yeah, and I think this is one reason why Mrs. Eddy had such respect for the Apostle Paul. Because when he was Saul, you know, he had a deep commitment, if you will, or assurance that the Hebrew way was right and that Christianity was wrong. And he had an honest conviction. And when he was beaten down, if you will, realizing that his honest conviction wasn't as good as it wasn't in the right direction, he turned on a dime and became one of the finest apostles of Christianity at the time. But he felt the truth deep in his soul. He knew how to get into his, how to dig deep. He was used to digging deep into his own consciousness. And so he was able to be used by God to do really good things.
Yeah,
he was willing to do hard things because of God too.
Yeah, thank you. Go ahead, Florence.
Yeah, the same zeal that he was using going the wrong way is the same zeal. It was just an incredible conviction of the truth. So he went the right way after his conversion.
Thank you.
Yeah, and we should have that same zeal for what we consider to be the truth, right? And we happen to be blessed to be given the textbook of Christian Science. So it should be a little easier for us than it was for Saul.
Yeah.
And you know, truth inspires confidence and courage. You can't separate those things. That was very much part of that zeal that we have to carry with us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we are an example to others.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This reminds me of what Mrs. Eddy says in Miscellaneous Writings. I make strong demands on love, call for active witnesses to prove it, and noble sacrifices and grand achievements as its result. So that's quite a high bar.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Now, in the responsive reading, says it is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed because his compassions fail not. And in this most beautiful article, again, that Carrie sent, it was about the prodigal son. But I'd like to go into it because it makes a really good point. There's so many things about the prodigal son, but this made a point that I don't think I've thought about too much. And it's very important. It talks about the prodigal son, but you can apply it to anybody or anything, you know, a spouse, a good friend, a brother or sister. But it's called The Father and the Prodigal Son by Ida Nelson Lockwood. The parable of the prodigal son, the pearl of parables, Mrs. Eddy calls it, abounds in valuable lessons applicable at all times to the experiences incident to the precious human relationship of a parent and a child. And again, this talks about a parent and a child, but it can be all kinds of things. And she says that Jesus, no doubt, had in thought our Heavenly Father and desired to illustrate his enduring loving kindness toward all his children in this story. And then any loving kindness toward all his children. And since the real man exists as the image and likeness of God, the proper attitude for mankind to seek to hold under all circumstances must be that of God-likeness. In such human experiences, it is not unusual for the parent to suffer far more keenly than does the child. Not until the child reaches the extremity of prodigality does his anguish begin to equal that of his parents. In the parable, however, Jesus does not draw such a picture. Here we find the father patiently permitting the son to choose his own course and learn for himself that good can never be found in evil. Then we find him tenderly expecting and awaiting the return of the wayward one. There is no note of disappointment, anger, resentment, hardness, or despair on the part of the father. Here one may say, you are asking the impossible when expecting a parent to maintain such a poise while seeing a child wasting his opportunities, his money, and even his health, recklessly disregarding the consequences. Now, isn't that true? Doesn't that sometimes happen? Somebody you love and they're you start to feel worse than the child that's having the problem or whoever it is that's having the problem. But in the prodigal son, the important point is that our Heavenly Father never beholds his children as prodigal. And so when one tires of thinking of himself in the sight and desires to return to his true state, the readjustment is wholly with the child. To the perfect sense of the Father, the Son has always walked in the paths of righteousness. The teaching of Christian Science brings us to an earthly parent his understanding of true existence, enabling him to see that the waywardness is simply an unreal dream, expressing the belief in an evil mind capable of experiencing pleasure and in materiality. And it goes on, but it just shows how the father was just at peace. He didn't let himself get upset over what was happening to someone that he loved, even though it seemed pretty awful. And it's very easy to fall into that. you know, to start to worry about it. But he said, Christ's truth opens our eyes to man's true nature. And the result is the same, whether one is ignorantly or wickedly wandering from his true sense of life, and whether the wandering has been for a longer or shorter period. In either case, the impoverished state is wholly a mental condition which yields to the true sense of life as God, made manifest in holiness, harmony, and abundance. This parable reveals that it is not inevitable that the father suffer for the child. Moreover, it implies that the attitude of the father is instrumental in bringing the child back to a wholesome state of right thinking. To ask a human parent to admit that his own harmony is dependent upon the whole being of his children may seem to be asking too much, and yet this must be the first step in solution of this problem. So, anyone else wants to speak about that? But it's quite important to understand this.
I experienced it, and I mean, probably many others, but it is when your peace is dependent on that of the child, it was very hard to find that peace until they were basically held as God's child and demanded they learn from him whatever they needed. And he came back saying he needed us and it was the right thing to do to be with us until he could stand on his own. So it did work, but those months or years was quite a, I just had to surrender him to God and do my best.
Thank you. Yeah, I know you went through that. I don't know if others of you had. Go ahead.
It kind of reminds me of in the article called Moral Idiocy, it talks about error trying to provoke us. And when our children, even our adult children sometimes can seem to do that like no one else can. And I think the watchword should just be, I will not be provoked. I have to see these, you know, these are not my responsibility. That's a false responsibility to think that you, even to go so far as to say, I have to teach them about God. They have to know, they know about God because it's written in their heart. And yes, you teach them by your example and you say what you are led to say, but it's not your responsibility. They are God's children. So it's just, this story reminds me of that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I know I have come to learn, well, for myself, I needed a certain amount of suffering and I needed a certain, you know, I needed to crash and burn before I was ready for Christian Science. So when I look at my kids out there in the world, I just think, okay, you're going through that time. You're getting what you need. You will eventually see that all of that is nonsense, and then you'll turn to God. And I actually kind of rejoice in it, you know, even when they tell me hard things. Excellent. So, because otherwise I'd be sitting at home fretful, and that wouldn't do me or anyone any good.
And what a liberating attitude that is, because it is so easy to get upset when people that you love, you know, siblings, children, parents, whatever, don't do what you think they should do.
And the other part of it is, at this point, having gone through it all and being where I am now, it would be awful if somebody came in and took away that suffering so that I did not rise higher. So I don't want to do that to them. I don't want to take away what they're learning. I don't want to take these lessons from them. It's super important for everybody to learn the lessons they need. And it's not up to me to figure it out. God will do it. So
Thank you.
So their suffering or whatever they're going through is their opportunity to really know God more, better.
Yes.
So.
Yep.
Thank you. At the same time, we know the divine love, being love and so much goodness, does not want God's children to just suffer. And that's not really, that's kind of old doctrine, right? The way Mary Baker Eddy also related this, about this, was with this quote. So wonderful. It says, science is here to show us the way of attaining the image and likeness of the divine, not through suffering, as did Jesus, but through spiritual understanding. What a wonderful quote she left us about the old doctrine of, you know, we need to suffer and we have to suffer. But clearly she's saying, no, if we get a spiritual understanding, then we skip the suffering. And she even said, as did Jesus. And that quote is on 12 Years with Mary Baker Eddy. So grateful for that quote to clear out the old doctrine of suffering.
Thank you.
We don't need to suffer if we already know what we should do. But sometimes that's why it says trials are proofs of God's care. I mean, we have to see whatever they're going through as their opportunity to get to know God more. I mean, I did that myself. If I hadn't gone through all that I was going through, I probably would never have known God or desired to know God to the extent that I know him now. So that can be the same thing for them. We see it as suffering, but again, we can change our own thought about, well, what an opportunity you have to know God more, you know.
And yes, exactly. And she also left that wonderful quote in Science and Health, we learn through science or through suffering. Mm-hmm. So again, it's telling us, no, God's will is not your suffering, and we don't need to suffer if we know the truth, like Jesus said. So all those things have been such a blessing for taking out of the way the old doctrine that we need to suffer and that God wants us to suffer. Thank God for Christian Science for bringing this spiritual understanding. I'm very grateful.
Thank you.
Yes, and I think the important lesson from this parable is that the Father didn't condemn the Son for doing what he did and for suffering for it. And neither should we condemn anybody because they are suffering. In a position as having an opportunity to grow spiritually, mm-hmm. and to be there for them when they're ready.
And all that, I guess, and all that time, just keep knowing that, well, good, God is with them. You know, he's helping them through awakening them to whatever they need to see. So
yeah, they make their bed and
so thank you for that. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we should not condemn or judge anybody, period, anyway, right?
No.
That's right.
You know, yes. Another lesson from that prodigal son, just kind of thinking through that, what enabled the father to remain kind of hands off the entire time, there was no tending of the regulator. And that's something that I have really, really come to, a healthy fear of that, because I feel like that's God working in someone's life, and God forbid I put my hands on it and try to steer it or direct it. That's just awful. That's human do-goody. And in the Bible, we also hear about, and the way that it's described in the Bible is steadying the ark. If you remember, if you touch the ark, and you weren't like what the Levites, you would like die instantly. So something to that effect. So yeah, don't study the ark of God. You know, God knows infinitely better than any of us what needs to happen. And so we can prayerfully support and know that God is working even in the most difficult situations.
Thank you very much. Yes. Yeah, it's a wonderful example, the Father, how he just was peaceful and at peace with himself, with God, with the prodigal son, the son that left. He didn't let it upset him, and he just waited patiently, peacefully, and expectantly for good, and it happens. It does happen when we are strong in his might.
Please. But it did give me peace to keep praying for my son while he was off. And when I felt at peace, then I felt that he would, everything was going to work out fine. Yeah, I could still see him clearly as being obedient and doing the right thing. But often I had to pray to bodily, actually, and mentally feel that everything was okay. Yeah. And then when I felt that, then I would be fine.
Thank you.
So we don't have to stop working because somebody else.
Yes.
Yeah. Never stop working. Yeah.
And that is another good article from Carrie about waiting time. And you might think you're waiting and nothing's happening. And we have talked about this before, but waiting is very important. It says the dictionary gives this definition of the word wait, to watch, to stay in expectation. And what is that but to hope and quietly wait? An added definition is to serve. Waiting in Christian Science loses all suggestion of idleness or just killing time and means instead a probationary period in which one may study to know more of principle. And it means further an opportunity to have a mental house cleaning to find out what one is holding in consciousness that would hinder demonstration from being instantaneous. We realize that just as the rest in music is quite as important to the harmony as the note, so the waiting time is just as necessary in our lives as the so-called active time, provided we use it intelligently. It is a trial of our obedience to prove to us, he who knows how to wait scientifically knows how to serve. And Jesus, the supremely obedient one, gave us a sublime example of intelligent waiting in his 3 days in the tomb, proving for all the powerlessness of the belief of death to destroy life. So yes, we're not just waiting idly, and we're not running around trying to do a bunch of stuff, but I love how it describes it. We're getting closer to God, that waiting time, a probationary period to cleanse our thought even more so. And I think it was Bik Dal Young. He says, you don't look for the demonstration. You just look for a greater knowledge of God, greater understanding of him. And the demonstration will come.
That waiting speaks to the other story about the 5 talents, and they were waiting for him to return. And I decided to look up slothful. I kind of thought of it just lazy, but it has really a deeper meaning. And I think it speaks to what you just said, that waiting time is active. But in the Bible, slothful means a spiritual and practical failure to do the work, duties, and responsibilities that God has given you. And I thought that was very a strong, important thing to keep in mind.
Thank you. Yeah.
With this story.
Yeah. And that's such an important parable that's in the lesson this week. So, and what does it mean? You don't use your talents.
You lose them.
Mm-hmm. Those that use them get more. So we must always be using our God-given talents. So anyone else? I'm going to share something from the Independent Christian Scientist that I thought was so sweet about Gilbert Carpenter. Maybe I'll have Gary read it. It's written by Ralph Spencer, who was taught by Gilbert Carpenter. And just read to, I think to hear.
By Ralph Spencer, and he writes, "Most everyone who knew the Carpenters and knew what they stood for felt the loving sincerity of their thought. When malicious gossip was occasionally voiced, they would listen politely but would soon begin to unfold the impersonal nature of error and show how an individual, even though erroneously influenced, would rise up and express the good and the true if the cloud of mesmerism were removed from him. In the local church activities of the Carpenters, Gilbert Jr. was considered a very fine reader and a very alert and effective committee on publication for Rhode Island. His father was considered a fine soloist and an excellent reader, serving as first reader for 7 years just prior to Mrs. Eddy's insertion of the 3-year clause into the manual. Some spoke of attending Wednesday evening meetings to hear those wonderful testimonies from the voice in the balcony. Mr. Carpenter Sr. frequently gave beautiful, healing testimonies from the balcony, which inspired or healed many listeners. And there were some who never knew whose voice it was. One newcomer to Christian Science was taken severely ill in the middle of the night. When asked what doctor or practitioner she wanted, she replied that she wanted the man with the voice from the balcony. Her daughter knew who it was and called Mr. Carpenter, and in a few minutes, she was completely healed."
What a beautiful description of Carpenter, and I love that. He would just know the impersonal nature of error and show how an individual, even though erroneously influenced, would rise up and express the good and the true if the cloud of mesmerism were removed from him. It's always true. It's always a cloud of mesmerism. So we'll end today. This is a little long, but it's a very good, makes some good points about the true fisherman and the God-filled net, also referring to responsive reading in our lesson this week.
And this is by Grace M. Putnam. "To his first disciples, Jesus said, 'Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men.' And they left all and followed him. They heard the loving advice, 'Cast the net on the right side of the ship, and ye shall find.' Did they wake to the true significance of the Master's teaching? Their eyes were then opened to see that seeking first the kingdom of God and his righteousness is casting the net on the right side. And that all these things shall be added unto you was illustrated by the full net. With humble, obedient thought, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy, prepared her net for her work as a fisherman. She saw to it that it was woven together with the cords of divine intelligence and wisdom and unselfed love. Then she cast her net forth and left it for God to fill, well knowing that it would gather in all who were struggling in the tempestuous waters of sin, sickness, sorrow, discouragement, fear, or lack, and bring them back safely to the shore, to the feet of the Christ. We who would follow in our leader's footsteps must learn, as did she, to be brave as well as humble. Like Peter, we must all launch out into the deep waters and anchor, cast our net there and leave it. The temptation often comes to pull it up to see how much has been accomplished. instead of knowing that God never fails to do his work. The true fisherman is a marvel of patience. He has learned that it is good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord. Persistence and perseverance are qualities possessed by the true fisherman and are alone worthy to win the prize. Persistence that refuses to drift with the tide, but works with anchor thrown out until, by unmistakable signs, he gets the command to move on. Perseverance that keeps on in spite of difficulties and seeming defeat, in spite of cold disdain or possible hate, loving more, working harder, in order to learn the lesson these experiences are sure to teach. Having done our part aright thus far, we may still have to learn the lesson of silence. The Master sometimes said, "See thou tell no man." He saw the unwisdom of drawing the criticism of antagonistic thought on the work just accomplished and stirring up undesirable opponents. We may become discouraged at what seems lack of success, or we may become self-complacent at what appears like a great accomplishment. In either case, it behooves us to examine our net very carefully and to replace the strand of personality with unselfishness. The thought that says we as persons have or have not done something must be cast out. If we neglect to get rid of that pernicious strand, we shall soon find ourselves toiling through the night without success. Find that our net is broken because of its weak strand, and we have lost our fishes. Mrs. Eddy puts it beautifully in Miscellaneous Writings, page 111, where she says, quote, "Faithfully as meekly you have toiled all night, and at break of day caught much. At times your net has been so full that it broke. Human pride, creeping into its meshes, extended it beyond safe expansion. Then, losing hold of divine love, you lost your fishes, and possibly blamed others more than yourself. But those whom God makes fishers of men will not pull for the shore. Like Peter, they launch into the depths, cast their nets on the right side, compensate loss, and gain a higher sense of the true idea. Nothing is lost that God gives. Had he filled the net, it would not have broken." End quote.
Thank you all so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was wonderful.